Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, did the reflation trade come back just a little bit too quickly? All of a sudden, the yield curve is flattening once again, and markets are playing defense. Some investors say they also see shades of August. It's also that time of year, with less than 6 weeks to go until 2020, firms across Wall Street are starting to share their thoughts and ideas for the year ahead.
And of course, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. And Sarah, before we get to that, I got to say I'm excited. As usual on podcast day, I'm excited about two things. One is we got a pretty good call to the podcast hotline, to the What Goes Up hotline. So we'll save that for the craziest thing. The other thing I'm excited about is, I don't know if you've noticed, but my Delaware Blue Hens basketball team is undefeated, 6-0. The woebegone basketball team of the University of Delaware.
I must say, I hadn't noticed. I'm very sorry about that, Mike.
Not many people have noticed, but you have,
and that's what matters.
Your Michigan team's also undefeated.
At
3-0, though, so we are twice as undefeated as you. I'm just going to throw that out there. Probably not for long.
We'll see how we do with the new coach.
But to honor the occasion, we actually have a guest from the great state of Delaware joining us here. Unfortunately, he did not go to the University of Delaware. He went to our conference rival, James Madison. So we won't talk basketball with him about that at all. But we're happy to have him. His name is Luke Tilley. He's the chief economist at Wilmington Trust in Wilmington, Delaware. And he's a former officer at the Philadelphia Federal Reserve. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Also joining us, our very own bonds and FX reporter and skilled equestrian, I would say, Katie Greifeld. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Right. How's the horse doing?
His name is Batman, and he's doing great.
He's good. I used to think his name was Fat Man, but I was mistaken. It is Batman.
Batman is a much better, maybe more polite, accepting name than Batman, Mike.
Right. I misunderstood. Yeah. My bad. Anyway, Luke, let's start with you. I downloaded Wilmington Trust has a very interesting capital markets forecast for 2020 on the website. I advise everyone to download it. It's a pretty good read, and I like it because it gets into some of the sort of hot topics of the day, not just really financial, but politics, populism, that sort of thing. I advise everyone, print this out and bring it to Thanksgiving dinner. So when it comes time to talk politics, you're well-armed. But I wanted to read a line from it that I think is really fascinating. I think this explains a lot of what we're seeing in the world today, whether it be Hong Kong or Chile or sort of the U.S. political landscape. And it goes, the rise in populism is in part of an outgrowth of the unintended consequences of productivity, which includes more gains for owners than workers and the secular disruption of the labor force. For example, labor share of income remains low. The figure dropped from 56.5% at the turn of the 20th century to 50.9% in 2014. And it will continue to drive populist sentiment. I find this stuff fascinating because I think this is a key theme of sort of global geopolitics. And like I said, this unrest we've seen in Hong Kong, in Chile, a lot of Latin America. How does one take this and apply it to the sort of the investment landscape?
Yeah, sure. So it's quite a mouthful. I don't know if you would try and do it at Thanksgiving, at Thanksgiving dinner. But of course, we were packing quite a bit of information into that paragraph. But simply put, the rise of populism around the globe, though, if you just read headlines, you might think is coming from sort of random success of populist leaders or particular movements that just happen to get more popular. But really, at its core, is this rise in productivity with firms. And firms have turned to robotics and artificial intelligence, all kinds of technology that increases their productivity. And one of the outcomes of that is that less of income, less of GDP is actually going to the worker. We had a fairly steady share of GDP going to workers, if you look at U.S. data, for about 4 or 5 decades, until the past 15 or 20 years, when you see this steady decline in the amount that's going to workers. So in our view, on top of some of there, admittedly, there are some other things. You've got the outsourcing of jobs. You've got some of those other things. But both in the U.S. and worldwide, you've got less and less income going to workers. And that tends to produce a populist sentiment.
The connection makes sense. And looking at your research, I grouped it as the three P's. You have productivity, populism, and then portfolio. But I can imagine some people coming to you and saying, what do you mean productivity is on the rise? You look at some data points and it still shows that productivity is really low. Is the problem that there's still the conundrum of people just not potentially measuring productivity in the right way in this new era of technology and other industries?
Yes, exactly. So this is something that we dug into quite a bit this year, and it's twofold, really. One is that it's very challenging to measure productivity. And then the second is that productivity tends to show up with a pretty significant lag. So on the first point, when the economy is changing very quickly, as it is now, we term this the fourth industrial revolution with the development of all of these technologies. When the economy is changing very quickly, it's incredibly hard for our government statisticians down in D.C. to keep track of it. In the late 1990s, this happened as well. There was this same conundrum that we had right now. How is it possible that we have all this growth and we have low unemployment, yet we don't have inflation going up? And the answer at that time was productivity. When you went several years later, when they had a better handle on what was going on, productivity was revised up about 1.5% for a 3 or 4 year period. And our view is that's exactly what's going on right now. The government is not very good at keeping track of just how productive Amazon is, for example, or Uber or some of these other companies. They'll get a better handle on it later. But right now, we believe that that productivity is actually stronger than the statistics show. And that, of course, is what's helping keep inflation low right now and not having those price pressures.
All right, let's get right into those Thanksgiving political discussions.
How fun.
with your drunk uncles.
Mike, you're a week early. We don't need this yet.
But you have to have the ammunition to counter those drunk uncles. I'm probably the drunk uncle in my scenario, but for everyone
at least
else,
you know it.
For you nephews and nieces out there. And you start off this this report, this 2020 Capital Markets Outlook. You kind of give the risks if there's a Democrat elected or a Republican. Very interesting one, looking at if there's a left-leaning government. The wealth tax. This is a third rail issue for a lot of people. Wilmington Trust, according to this report, gives it a high chance of happening if a Democrat is elected, but a low impact on markets. Walk us through what the thinking is with that.
Right. So this is obviously a politically sensitive one. And we should say that all of our research is just really not meant to be a judgment over whether these things are good, bad, or indifferent, but just looking at what the impact would be on markets.
Right.
But clearly the wealth tax is something that has the attention of voters on the left right now and supporters of the candidates in the Democratic primaries. So a wealth tax would be incredibly challenging if it were implemented in terms of the execution of it and keeping track of wealth. We actually think it's more likely that we'll end up getting higher taxes in some other form, either the reversal of the taxes that were implemented in 2018, those tax cuts, mm-hmm. or perhaps increases in taxes somewhere else. You know, that's on the personal side. That's also on the corporate side. But clearly there's some support for the wealth tax right now. But there's a lot of sort of devil in the details on how you would go about implementing that.
Right. It'd be very tough to appraise someone's wealth on a year-to-year basis if you...
And then you get the dynamic effects. They try to get their wealth out. Several right. of the proposals want to penalize that. It would be incredibly messy.
Right.
But it's clearly going to be a topic of discussion throughout 2020.
People digging holes in their backyard with filling it with gold and Bitcoin, I guess. So. that's what you do with Bitcoin, Katie, right?
That's what I hear.
Yeah, right. Okay, good.
There was a really interesting story out this week, actually, about high wealth individuals all of a sudden very interested in very normal types of storage.
Box.
Yeah, safety deposit box, because who knows? Who knows what's going to happen with rates lately? With that said, though, and bringing it kind of into Katie's world of FX and rates, Luke, I first want to ask you, because also in the notes that were sent over to us, they said that the way you guys see it, tightening of monetary policy is a ways off, which I think the Fed has made very clear, despite global central banks taking a breather from incremental monetary easing. I want to get your take, though, because a few people this week have said to me that now what it looks like the market is doing with yields moving lower once again, defensives and equities coming back to the fore, that maybe the market is actually pricing in the idea that the Fed will have to cut again. And we're still stuck in this virtuous circle where the market prices in a cut and then the Fed feels as though they have to cut. Do you think it's possible we do get back to this that scenario, say, within the next year?
We do think it's possible, but we don't think it's the highest chance outcome, if you will. So a lot of what the Fed was doing was basically fixing the yield curve, if you will. Listeners out there, you can't see me putting the air quotes around the word fixing. but that's essentially what they were doing. So Jerome Powell never used this term, but essentially when the yield curve inverts, they get pretty nervous about that. Mm-hmm. And even though they don't, as I said, they don't use that as, well, we need to do that, that was clearly part of it. The yield curve back to where it is right now, as you said, flat. A little bit more this week. But the Fed has gotten themselves in a spot where, as they said, they want to wait and see how long it takes and what the impacts of their rate cuts are. Clearly, it is having an impact so far. But really, we don't think that they would end up cutting more rates unless the economy took a material turn downwards. What could cause that to happen? It's not our view that the economy is going to take a material turn downwards unless we get more tariffs. If you get more tariffs on between U.S. and China, more brinksmanship there, we think that that would end up leading them down that way. But that's not our view right now. On the other side of whether they would be raising interest rates, they don't have a history of reversing themselves and changing directions very quickly. That would be obviously problematic to markets, which are maybe looking for more cuts. And there's really not enough time over the next 6 to 9 months for inflation to do a U-turn and really move materially upwards for them to want to be hiking rates. And so then, you know, if you can't have material inflation within the next 6 to 9 months, you get out to 12 months and then you're right before the election. They're not going to really want to cause problems just before that. So we think it's pretty flat from here unless you get that material downturn.
And that reversal in the yield curve is a lot more of their open market operations to sort of fix the whole repo mess, adding liquidity. I think the balance sheet's expanded by close to $300 billion by now. I mean, is that's just going to continue apace as long as that there's funding stress in the repo market, do you think?
Yeah, so this is where it gets really confusing at Thanksgiving dinner. If you want to, if you want to talk about Fed policy and their monetary policy at the short end of the curve and what they're doing with rates, and then also what they're doing with buying treasuries to expand their balance sheet. It can get a little bit convoluted. Clearly, their balance sheet, as you suggested, is now expanding. It has been since the beginning of September. But that's not really on the rate cut side. That's providing the liquidity to markets and all those problems that happened in the repo market. So and this is challenging for them to talk about, really. They have to keep doing that in order to provide liquidity. And I think they're doing their best they can to convince people that it's not quantitative easing and it's not them easing policy.
Katie, come in here. You had a story that ran on Sunday called "The Bond Market's Fate Hangs in Balance Before Trade War Crunch Time," in which you talked about the rise up that we've seen in bond yields and what comes next. As Luke mentioned, trade is really a large trigger that we have to keep an eye on. But what are investors telling you this week? Because we've seen the 10-year fall roughly 20 basis points or so or more. I mean, what's driving this? And is the path for least resistance at this point lower?
That's a great question. I mean, it feels like the answer changes every day, depending on the trade headlines we're getting as to where yields are headed next. And a stat I love that's in that article is that if you look at 10-year treasury yields, they're extremely correlated to the Chinese yuan right now, which I think just goes to show how much of sentiment in the bond market relies on trade. So when I talk to investors, I talk to strategists in the bond market specifically, it's trade. It's all about trade. And we're really entering, you know, a crucial few weeks before December 15th and that tariff deadline.
Meanwhile, the other market you cover, Katie, FX has really been, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess quite boring this
fest.
Year, right? You had another story out this week about the dollar being in the tightest range for a year, the dollar index, the ICE dollar index being in the tightest range for a year since 1976. let's pretend I didn't edit that story, and you can just tell me what the takeaway from that story is.
Yeah, it's really been feast and famine because the bond market's been going crazy, but nothing has been happening in FX. And you mentioned the DXY index. That's how you can find it on the terminal. But yeah, it's stuck in its tightest range in about over four decades.
Four decades.
Yeah, it was not close to alive, but that really has to do with...
It's especially crazy if you were born before 1976 and have to think about how it's almost five decades now. But go on.
It's still got a four handle, but yeah, so that index is mostly made up of the euro-dollar pair, which is, this is an even crazier stat, it's on track for its narrowest yearly range on record. And I was talking to SocGen about that, and Kit Jukes told me that's just because the market's almost been too accurate in pricing growth differentials in Europe and America. We're priced for pretty good news in America and bad economic news out of Europe and Germany in particular, and that's really what we're getting.
Right. Now, Luke, this very quiet volatility in the FX market, it's terrible news to our FX traders, listeners, I'm sure. It's the worst possible outcome one could ever think of. But I have to wonder, for the economy, as far as looking at financial conditions, I mean, it's a tight range. It is elevated compared to last year. But I would think that a sort of diminished volatility in the FX market is kind of good for financial conditions. Am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, it helps with financial conditions, especially with an increasingly integrated world where you've got so many companies that are operating across borders and they basically have to deal with these FX rates on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis. And those more solid or less volatile FX conditions just make it easier to operate, and they just definitely encourage more trade. When you have all of the uncertainty that Katie mentioned coming from trade and all of the uncertainty that's coming from that, and even some uncertainty about fiscal policy, to have one thing that is a little bit more stable is going to be supportive of growth in our view.
All year long, I've heard about how a strong dollar is a headwind to corporate profits. And finally, just a couple months ago, people thought that, well, maybe that was about to change. We saw the dollar started turning lower before it started picking up once again. But in your story, Katie, you talk about how corporates might be caught off guard in a different way. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So usually when people think about FX effects, they think about, you know, how is it eating into earnings? But what reporting this story out showed is that corporations have become, or might be at risk of becoming, a bit complacent when it comes to just hedging the currency risk. And we spoke to a few different firms, and they said it's not, you know, their huge multinational clients or the pension funds. It's these smaller companies, maybe, you know, 50 to 70 employees who have pretty bare bones treasury departments or accounting staff that are, you know, after several years where nothing has happened in FX, they're kind of stepping back their hedging activity because it's expensive and it hasn't paid off for several years. But obviously, you know, with record volatility at record lows, you know, the risk is that it shoots up really quickly. So there, I think we have a quote in there that this puts, you know, destroy profits at risk. You know, if you're a small company hedging less.
Luke, any thoughts on what the dollar is going to do in 2020?
Yeah, we don't really put out projections of that, but I would agree with Katie's sentiment that basically traders and FX traders have been predicting the economies, right? Because fundamentally, what's going to end up driving currency and currency movements is how are the economies performing relative to one another, and then what are central banks doing? So, as Katie said, a lot of what is going on right now has been predicted. We predicted the industry, whatever was priced in, was a slowdown in U.S. growth this year. Right now, not expecting a huge reacceleration in trade and tariffs. Some sort of reasonable answer to the whole Brexit question, and that the European Central Bank has got a new leader, and she's not going to make any big changes right away. Right. So if all that's priced in, you still get those growth trajectories, then it should be fairly stable, and we wouldn't expect any big movements in the dollar or any other currencies. You could imagine some sort of compilation and some sort of collection of surprises, such as trade and tariffs going bad, a hard Brexit when it's not expected, or, you know, any of those things getting upended. And then you would expect to see some more volatility. So So it's inherently hard thing to predict, but basically we're just putting our judgments around those risks of those things happening at all times.
Right. I think when you're in a low volatility phase, the hardest thing to do is try to predict what's going to snap it out of. Everyone wants to do it, but it's almost impossible.
Right. And one thing's usually certain is that it's been this low volatility for this long. It's probably not going to be the same the next year.
Right.
Something's going to happen.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I wanted to get back to that 2020 outlook of from Wilmington Trust, and especially talk about sort of the policies that have potentially bipartisan support. And I like the way you guys do this. You give these bubbles that say if it has a high chance or a low chance, and it's in big print. I can read it even without my reading glasses on. So I appreciate that from us on the older end here. Antitrust, medium chance. Medium impact, drug price reform, medium chance, medium impact. So we'll skip those. China trade, obviously another Thanksgiving topic that's bound to come up. You guys give it a high chance and a high impact, which obviously I think I agree with, especially given that this is a bipartisan issue now. So I wonder, you know, so many people are trying to game theory out, the Trump and President Xi negotiations and who's got the upper hand, who's got the weaker hand, and what it means for when we'll actually see a deal, even a phase one deal. But what, as you guys point out here, is that, a tougher stance on China trade is a bipartisan issue. I mean, is it conceivable, believable that... a lot of the thinking is that, well, China will just wait out President Trump. They think there's a decent chance he won't get reelected. They can stall and just wait for the next president to negotiate with. Is that a bad way of thinking about it, do you think?
There's so many different ways to think about it. And as you said, trying to game theory it out, it has entirely too many nodes. Yeah. But I think you hit on it, and it's such a bipartisan issue. I mean, just this week you had the Senate unanimously approved this bill that has to do with Hong Kong and retaining their independence. Elizabeth Warren and Ted Cruz were both co-sponsors, not just voters, but co-sponsors of this bill.
How often do you see that?
And the House voted, I think it was 417-1 to approve this. So if you needed a clearer signal of it being a bipartisan issue, I guess you need 418-0. But it's clearly a bipartisan issue, which means that it's not going away. I don't know how the Chinese will try to play it out, but where we've gotten ourselves is we've implemented these tariffs. We've got deadlines coming up, and it'd be sort of hard to back away from entirely because there are so many human rights issues. Both parties have been upset about China and the way that they subsidize their state-owned enterprises and the way that they steal intellectual property for so long that we view this, as you said, as a high chance of something happening, whether it's a series of deals or even if somebody else comes in, a new president gets elected, then there's clearly going to be some more action taken after that.
Yeah. So bottom line it for us, what kind of portfolio would you want to be in heading into 2020? What sort of asset allocation would you be looking at?
All right. So just recently, after earlier this year, when the trade talks broke down, we had gone to basically neutral against our benchmarks in equities and on the fixed income side. Just last month, we went back overweight to equities because we've actually gotten pretty optimistic. we're not sure what a phase one deal is going to look like, whether that pulls back any tariffs or anything like that. But we're fairly confident that we're not going to see more tariffs coming on. Basically, both economies are in such bad shape right now, especially relative to May, that we decided to move back into equities. And we think that it's a good time to be taking on a little bit more risk and taking on a little bit more of that beta.
All right, so now I know what you guys are looking for heading into next year, but I think that brings us to the craziest thing all of us ever saw this week.
That's right. Let's start with the call to the hotline. I found this call pretty interesting.
So his name is John. He's a financial advisor out of the Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area. And he told us that this is not just the craziest thing he ever saw this week, Mike, but it's actually maybe the craziest thing he ever saw over the past decade to 15 years. He's referring to a mutual fund. It's ticker PRWCX. It's the T. Rowe Price Capital Appreciation Fund. And he points out just its performance, how it's been doing so well over the past couple of years. Take a listen.
This thing is absurd. It's outperformed its category over the last 5, 10, 15 years. It's the number one performing fund in its category. This is an asset allocation fund, so it usually has anywhere from 30% in bonds. And regardless of that, it's still, over that 15-year time frame, it's outperformed the S&P while taking significantly less risk.
It's pretty good. And I'm going to assume John is who he says he is, not a T. Rowe Price salesman on the phone there.
We don't have a last name, John, so that's on you.
But I believe you, John. I believe you.
I did fact check him on the numbers. The fund is outperforming over the last 15 years and 20 years, but over the last 5 years, it's actually lagging the S&P by just a tad.
All right. Well, maybe we'll have to try to get the manager of that on here to talk about it. That's pretty good. All right. Katie, do you have a crazy thing you saw in markets this week?
I'm going to try my best. I love this story because I don't understand it, but it's about the grain market. And apparently we're seeing this weird trade. It's called the Over Chicago trade, where corn is being sent from the west to the east. And usually it just goes to the south. And my best understanding of why that's happening is because corn farmers in the east have been hoarding their corn supplies because there's been just this supply deluge, and they're hoarding it to wait on better prices, which I think would just exacerbate the problem. But I don't know. It's a crazy story. It's on the terminal. I encourage you to read it because I probably did a terrible job.
I like it. No, I like it. That's a good Thanksgiving themed story as well.
It is. Wow.
I want to pretend that's what I was thinking of. But yeah, the corn market.
Sarah, how about you? Can you top the crazy Chicago corn trade of whatever that was? I don't follow it either.
I have one that is pretty crazy, and there were a couple stories that came out about it this week. So PG&E, the power company that has been under a lot of pressure after they did start some of those horrible, horrible wildfires out in California, they're filed for bankruptcy. Shares are down 90% since mid-2017. Well, what's happening is because they have to compensate people out in California who say that their property was damaged, they're going through all these claims. And all of a sudden, this one claim popped up with someone claiming that the fire destroyed a 500-pound emerald worth $280 million that they're having in their house. So, of course, PG&E is a little bit suspect about this, so they're trying to find out more information. But Bloomberg's very own opinion columnist Matt Levine looked a little bit more into this, and it turns out that this emerald has likely been written about before. It actually has a name. The name is Beleza. I believe that's how you pronounce it. And it also was maybe cursed. So the way
clearly,
yes. So the way Matt Levine finishes his column is he says, I'm going to stop the emerald speculation at this point, but I just wanted to flag for you the possibility that PG&E might have caused a fire that destroyed a cursed emerald. So pretty crazy stuff.
Does that end up being a good omen?
That's what I'm not sure. Now, is the curse over now? I'm not sure.
I thought you were going to tell me that the emerald's name was Fat Man.
Oh, wow.
It comes back.
Full circle.
I mean, it is 500 pounds. Yeah. So.
But furthermore, emeralds are flammable? Like what?
That's what I thought. I thought, do emeralds burn?
Right. Apparently. At least if you can convince your insurance adjuster that
they do. Right.
Luke, have they told you about our gimmick here?
I heard a little bit about it, yes. So I did my best. But if you're asking for the craziest thing in markets, you bring in a macroeconomist, you're going to get something about the economy. And that's actually, I'm just going to put some context around something that we've already discussed, and it's about the Fed. and about the balance sheet, because you were right, Mike. You already mentioned that they had started to add to their balance sheet again. And that started, the low point was the week of August 26th. And when the Fed released their balance sheet data this week, turns out they have grown in total their balance sheet by $287 billion over 12 weeks. And just to put that in context, over 12 weeks, just that three-month period, the $287 billion is greater than the annual GDP of 145 of the 195 countries on this planet.
That's crazy.
That is pretty crazy,
you
right?
came prepared.
I did.
That was impressive.
Good. Very good. Very good.
I appreciate the heads up.
Nice. Well done. Well done. All right. I'll close with mine here. This is a stock, a company called ArtGo in Hong Kong. It's a company that produces marble, and I think they were trying to expand in the real estate and whatever. None of that's important. What's important is this stock was up 3,800% year to date. 3,800% the stock was up, a penny stock. Mainly because MSCI said that they would start including it in their indexes. So obviously people trying to front run that passive money that we'll chase it later. That MSCI said, you know what? Never mind. We're not going to include it in our indexes. We've gotten some complaints from investors. Quote, their quote is, further analysis and feedback from market participants on investability. In one day, the stock dropped 98%.
Wow. 98%. Tough day.
Wiped out $5.7 billion of market value with a one-day 98% drop. And that's the craziest thing I saw in markets.
I think all four are pretty crazy this week.
Yeah,
hats off. Yeah, hats off. And before we go, John from Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, I do want to let you know that Mike and I did hear your idea to explore indexed bond ETFs even further and talk about the potential liquidity. So we'll absolutely talk about it. And anyone else who is interested in giving us a call, leaving us a tip, or giving us an idea for the craziest things you ever heard or saw in markets this week, give us a call. That number is 646-324-3490. But with that, Luke Tilley, Katie Greifeld, thanks so much for coming on the show this week.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reaganonymous, and Katie Greifeld is at K Greifeld. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.